Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Can I Ask You Something? The Sex History Podcast. I'm your host, Sydney, and I hope everyone's been doing well since last month. It's Christmas time, best fucking time of the year. I'm so excited. I'm sad we're not getting a white Christmas this year, but at this point, I should be used to it. But I always stay hopeful. Thank you for joining me. And of course, this episode is going to have some graphic language, nothing negative, nothing violent, nothing like that. But, you know, cursing. I do say fuck a lot. I will be saying penis pretty often and coming, all types of stuff like that. So feel free to sit this one out if that makes you uncomfortable, and I'll catch you on the next one. Let's get into today's question.
Well, what's the hang up on masturbation? I thought we had moved on from that. It's 2024, but I still see people bragging on it, saying it's something that's dirty. What's up with that?
Now, let's get sexy. During 4th century BCE, the philosopher Diogenes blamed the god Hermes for introducing the world to masturbation because he taught his son Pan how to do it. Diogenes was known for his provocative antics, once going to Athens to protest the false morale and corruption of the society and citizens within it. He ate in the market, which was a faux pas, and masturbated publicly after declaring, "If only one could satisfy one's hunger by rubbing one's stomach," end quote. Physicians around 200 BC suggested masturbation as a way to relieve tension or sexual frustration. The idea stemmed from the belief that the body needed to rid itself of excess seminal fluid. Hippocrates, who was around 5th century BC, and Galen, who was around 2nd century AD, both thought it was necessary for men and women to orgasm regularly to release their seed. Around 200 BC, Demetrius of Apamea wrote in his book On the Sign of Diseases of an old man who suffered from priapism, who tried unsuccessfully to find relief through masturbating. His erection was so powerful that his organ might have been made of horn. End quote. That sounds horrible. But then came the 18th century with stomach issues, uncontrollable hunger, vomiting, nausea, low libido, chronic back pain, paleness, acne, thinness, memory loss, bouts of rage, decline in cognitive function, seizures, fever. This is just a short list of all the things that would happen to you if you masturbated, at least according to the unknown author of the 18th century book Onania. A young man's journey of self-mastery, directing, quote, men's eruptibility into one appropriate channel was key, the marital bed. In order to convince them that marriage was the perfect outlet for their sexual urges, Onania equated masturbation with the big three no-nos: fornication, adultery, and sodomy. In marriage, male desire must be given free rein, but the anonymous author, who's theorized to be John Martin, one of many other authors who are theorized to have written Onania, clarified his position in response to a lady's letter included in the 4th edition of the pamphlet, though it was likely fabricated. John Martin argued that all non-procreative sex within marriage should be considered onanism of sorts, equally sinful and dangerous. Furthermore, women should be allowed to decide when marital sex should not take place, for while, quote, the man be at all times capable of generation, the woman is not. And we'll get into women and masturbation later, but until then, y'all go ahead and theorize what direction that's going to go in. Because, yeah. Anyway, onanism, which is penis-centered masturbation, gets its name from a passage in the book of Genesis. When God killed Er, Er's father Judah ordered his son Onan to marry Er's widow Tamar and, quote, raise up seed with her. But when they lied together, Onan spilled his semen on the ground, knowing that fathering a son in his brother's line would deprive him of the larger part of his inheritance. This angered God, who then went on to kill Onan. On brand. Onania really kicked off masturbation phobia in Europe at first, Western Europe at first, and America had its own little bout with masturbation phobia a century later. Catholic and Protestant authorities set up masturbation as a heinous but forgivable sin. But what made it so sinful? It was the waste and spillage of precious, precious semen. A man's semen has one purpose: reproduction. No one's having sex for pleasure. Be serious. St. Augustine of Hippo, North Africa, thought that masturbation was sinful because it's unnatural. He suggested that it was better for a man to visit a prostitute than masturbate. Were you masturbating in the era of the 500s? Well, trust, you will be dealt with. Punishment depended on the offender's age. In the year 520, a year's penance for adult men versus 40 days for young boys who were around 12. Because in their minds, you're an adult. Where's your fucking self-control? The Irish penitential of St. Columban differentiated between married and unmarried masturbators. A year's penance for the former and 6 months for the latter. Married men, they're supposed to be making babies with their wives. And you're neglecting your duty as the seed supplier if you're masturbating. And that is more grave in sin. The unmarried dude, like, that's an excuse. He's lonely. Of course he's gonna jack off. But you need to go fulfill your role and fuck your wife and make a baby. Very simple. But sometimes someone ejaculates in their sleep. What was the rule on that? Well, let's run through the checklist. Were you awake when you had this emission? Sorry to break it to you, but you're a sinner. And this view was ratified in 1054 by Pope Leo IX, officially condemning masturbation as a sin. Our old friend Thomas Aquinas just couldn't bring himself to condemn nocturnal ejaculations in his discussions on the subject. In the fifth article of his Summa Theologiae, it was the cause of the ejaculation that mattered. But he definitely still believed that self-pollution was a sin against nature as severe as sodomy. But, there was some wiggle room there. He thought that the devil was behind nocturnal emissions, so it wasn't the ejaculator's fault. But did he think lustful thoughts? A sin. Did the dew come on purpose? Even more of a sin. Fornication, to Aquinas, was less of a sin in his book, because at least a baby could have come out of that. But wait, he also stated that masturbation was a form of murder. The potential of a human was destroyed. Come on. Up until the discovery of the microscope by Anton von Leeuwenhoek, it was believed that tiny, fully formed humans resided in sperm. And for some, men's masturbation was as heinous as abortion. The debates continued, and toward the end of the 16th century, the Franciscan Benedict declared, quote, "Whoever engages in voluntary pollution outside of marriage, which is termed Maleties by theologians, sins against the natural order." So, to summarize, masturbation was considered a mortal sin, but if it was a nocturnal emission, well, that's forgivable. Still a sin, but forgivable. The physician Robert Burton blamed celibacy for causing, quote, "masturbation, satyriasis, priapism, melancholy, madness, fornication, adultery, buggery, sodomy, theft, murder, and all manner of mischiefs," in a 1621 book, Anatomy of Melancholy. He said, quote, "idleness leads to lust, lust to disease, disease to timely death," which it sounds kind of similar to how we talk about the male loneliness epidemic, with people being like, well, why doesn't someone just fuck them? They won't be lonely anymore, you know? Anyway, I'm getting sidetracked. The Puritan Richard Capel condemned the solo act. In his 1640 treatise, he listed a litany of sins, of which onanism was the first by far, more than adultery and fornication, which is sex outside of marriage. Protestants opted to hamstring offenders. Literally. Like, literally slice their hamstrings. Ugh. Another medical book hit the shelves of Europe in 1760, L'Onanisme, by Samuel Auguste Tissot. He claimed that semen was an essential body oil, and when it was wasted through masturbation, it caused, quote, "a perceptible reduction of strength, of memory, and even of reason, blurred vision, all the nervous disorders, all types of gout and rheumatism, weakening of the organs of generation, blood in the urine, disturbance of the appetite, headaches, and a great number of other disorders." There was Dr. Robert James's 1745, A Medicinal Dictionary, which stated that onanism was responsible for, quote, "the most deplorable and generally incurable disorders." In France, young men were warned about the dangers of masturbation. One such 1830 pamphlet titled Dead at 17 shows a picture of a young boy, pale, obviously ill, with a bandage around his head. It was captioned, "He was young and handsome, his mother's pride and joy. But he died in torment, blind, sick, and paralyzed at the age of 17. If only he'd known the perils of masturbation, then he might have lived a better life. Writers and philosophers also join this dead, with Voltaire and Rousseau both attributing a catalog of symptoms to masturbation. When talking on education in 1766, Rousseau advised in his treatise Emile that a tutor should not leave his pupil the slightest opportunity to engage in masturbation. Quote, therefore, watch carefully over the young man. He can protect himself from all other foes, but it is for you to protect him against himself. Never leave him night or day, or at least share his room. Never let him go to bed till he is sleepy, and let him rise as soon as he wakes. End quote. He also added, I will not permit the purposes of nature to be evaded. If you must be a slave, I prefer to surrender you to a tyrant from whom I may deliver you. Whatever happens, I can free you more easily from the slavery of women than from yourself. But Rousseau couldn't escape the affliction of masturbation. Obviously, he wasn't alone, and the literature that was warning everyone about it wasn't much help either, but we'll get into that later. Immanuel Kant, in his 1797 Metaphysics of Morals, wrote, enormity of the violation perpetrated by man against the humanity subsisting in his person, by so unnatural and portentous a lust, which seems, as we have said, formerly to transcend in magnitude the guilt of self-murder, remains unexplained upon this argument, unless, perhaps, it might be urged that the headlong obstinacy of the suicide who casts away life as a burden is no effeminate surrender to sensitive excitement, but shews valor, and so leaves ground for referencing the humanity he represents, while this other resigns himself an abandoned outcast to brutality, enjoying his own self-abuse. That is, he makes himself an object of abomination and stands bereft of all reverence of any kind. Man gives up his personality when he uses himself merely as a means for the gratification of an animal drive. Now, there were warnings upon warnings to the public. It was like they were in abundance, but they weren't any good. Tissot had a case study involving a watchmaker who masturbated himself into, quote, insensibility on a daily basis, sometimes three times a day. He said, quote, I found a being that less resembled a living creature than a corpse, lying upon straw, meager, pale, and filthy, casting forth an infectious stench, almost incapable of motion. William Drummond, the son of a Scottish poet, wrote about his handiwork between 1657 and 1659 in his diary. After his mom died, he inherited a sizable estate at Hawthornden in 1649, which was a few miles outside of Edinburgh. And by the time he wrote in his journal, he had been living by himself for a while, save for, you know, a handful of servants. On February 20th, 1657, Drummond spoke about engaging in debauched behavior and cavorting with his fellow delinquents. Drank till 12 o'clock in the night, at which time we ranted thorough all the little towns with a great bagpipe to the admiration or astonishment of all the country people. He would laze about all day, not go to church on Sundays, and, well, with so much time on his hands, you can imagine where his thoughts turned to. He would use code to talk about masturbating, referring to it as fatal, all night fatal, fatal most grievously. His favorite book was Ovid's Ars Amandi, or The Art of Love, which at one reading turned him on so much that he masturbated twice. His activities caused him no harm, contrary to medical opinion, and he eventually did get married. But since he felt compelled to use code word, you can kind of glean that he may have had some negative associations with it, but we don't know. Of course, men like Drummond had the help of erotica and pornographic images like Le Code de Fille, or The School of Angels, which was published in 1655 by Michel Mirault, or Jean Lange, or L'Académie des Dames by Nicolas Croyer in 1660. Samuel Pepys was another man who recorded his masturbatory activities. After getting turned on while reading Le Code de Fille, he wrote in his diary on February 9, 1655, it did hazer my prick stand all the while, and une vez te décharger. A century later, James Boswell was concerned with the physical effects in his diary, referring to it as, quote, a fatal practice. He promised himself that he would stop and he would only pleasure himself with women, because, you know, women are just talking fleshlights, so. Libertine men formed secret societies in order to celebrate their activities. initiation ceremonies would use masturbation as a bonding mechanism, like in the secret society, the Beggar's Benison. The Beggar's Benison was formed by a collective of prominent Scottish professionals in 1732 to promote shared business interests and continue to operate until 1836. Another aspect of the initiation ceremony was the test platter, onto which all the members would ejaculate onto it as a sign of their virility. And sometimes they would also pay women to be at the meetings, and they would strip naked and pose for, quote, inspection by the members. Very weird, very weird. But, so, if people were masturbating anyway, shrouded in shame and guilt or not, why the frenzy? Well, it turns out sounding the alarm about the perils of masturbation was a hot commodity, and plenty of people were cashing in. Authors of sexual advice manuals like Nicholas Vinet shared that masturbating caused asthma, liver problems, fever, gout, sterility. Only affected men, because women are sexless, remember. Just an amalgamation of holes. An incubator. A maid. Vinet wrote in his 1686 Tableau de l'amour conjugal, which was translated to English 17 years later, that women just couldn't masturbate. Quote, woman does not have the ability to pollute herself, as does man, nor to expel the superfluous seed. She sometimes retains it lengthily in her testicles or in the horns of her uterus, where it becomes tainted and turns yellow and murky, or foul-smelling instead of clear and white as it was formerly. Which I think he's just referring to vaginal discharge. The public felt the book was decent enough for young married couples, but sex manuals were also generally deemed liable for inflaming the passions of young boys. John Martin, the theorized Onania author, was a quack, and he had written other books similar in style and content to Onania. Two medications that he presented as cures for a good old frickster was a strengthening tincture sold for 10 shillings a bottle and a prolific powder for 12 shillings a bag. And that was a lot of money for the time, and that was a lot of money that was well below the weekly wage of most laborers. And once again, we have physicians weighing in on something within the private and aiding in pathologizing it. A personal spin on just how bad choking the chicken or flicking the bean really could be. Medical texts showed pictures depicting delirious women swooning and on the verge of insanity and men crippled with fatigue. By the start of the 19th century, masturbation had been firmly linked to depravity, disabilities, and insanity. In his book, Medical Inquiries and Observations Upon the Diseases of the Mind, which was published in 1812, the Philadelphia psychiatrist Benjamin Rush declared that, quote, chronic aberrations frequently have been found in the cerebellum of the onanist. He linked pumping the red rocket with insanity and a litany of other side effects like seminal weakness, impotence, dysentery, pulmonary consumption, dyspepsia, dimness of sight, vertigo, epilepsy, hypochondriasis, loss of memory, and death. Masturbation became something bigger than itself. Now it was a scourge of nations. In France, Ravalier Paris, in his Revue Médicale Française et Étrangère in 1828, called it the destroyer of civilization. And other doctors agreed. Dr. François Glebe's explanation was that deterioration began in childhood and progressed to adolescence, taking with it, quote, the shared patrimony of a country's forces. The whole problem is seen to affect not only the individual, but society as a whole, which in a way makes sense if you think masturbating will turn a man into like a babbling idiot with a shortened lifespan. And it was happening everywhere, not just in France. You know, so maybe start offering better pay to your soldiers, I guess. Masturbators, the boogeyman, what's the difference? Blamed for a country's degeneration, for denying a nation its potential for strong manpower by enfeebling themselves and making them unfit to be fathers. 18th century sexuality writers masculinized masturbation because they strove to build manly citizens. What's a state without the foundation of the manliest men of their nation? I mean, Rousseau chose a male figure when he wrote Emile to allegorize the vile nature of masturbation. The professor Claude-François Lalemant, a practicing physician in Montpellier, expressed his concern that masturbation caused spermatorrhea, excessive sperm discharge, or involuntary ejaculations. In A Practical Treatise on the Causes, Symptoms, and Treatment of Spermatorrhea, which was published in 1835, Lalemant recorded 150 cases that he investigated throughout his 14 years of practice and concluded that masturbation degraded a man, quote, poisons the happiness of his best days, and ravages society. New inventions were being created to keep British Victorian children free from the vice. Early detection was imperative if they wanted to avoid a country full of defective children, after all. Children were warned to keep their hands above their bedclothes, no touchies. Parents were advised to make their kids wear spiked gloves to make sure they grew up normally. Erection detectors would wake up parents with ringing bells should their son get an erection while he slept. And straitjackets were suggested, but, I mean, compared to these other cures and treatments and stuff, like, that's pretty tame. In 1858, Dr. Isaac Baker Brown, president of the Medical Society of London, began to encourage clitoridectomies, or female circumcision, to prevent hysteria, epilepsy, mania, and death by masturbation. Samuel Smiles emphasized the need for restraint in his book Self-Help, which was published in 1859, and 1875's Thrift. Discipline was everything to an upstanding Victorian, especially self-discipline, and instilling the same level of that discipline in one's own children. Ellen E. Perkins, who was annoyed with the use continued self-fondling, invented a piece of equipment in 1905 for, quote, keeping the male pure. The invention encased the crotch in metal with leather reinforcement along the sides of the thighs and a center flap on the hinge to allow someone to urinate. It could be locked from behind so the wearer couldn't get out of it. Other preventative devices included the sleeping ring, the cup with padlock, the truss, the sheath, the hand jive, the penis plate, the locking pockets, the live wire, and the bodysuit. All of these devices inflicted pain as a curing method. Surgical methods were also implemented for repeat offenders, and in extreme measures, clitoridectomies and castration was suggested, but it was rare. Cauterization was also used, with the doctor burning the offending organ. Which is so crazy. I definitely was born in the right time. And the new fields of psychology and psychiatry also had something to add to the discourse. In 1867, Henry Maudsley, a recognized British psychiatrist, revealed the telltale signs of a masturbator was, quote, extreme perversion of feeling and corresponding derangement of thought. In earlier stages and later by failure of intelligence, nocturnal hallucinations, and homicidal and suicidal propensities. He identified masturbation as a mania of pubescence, or a sort of mental disease of egoism where the young patient fails to listen to others. It would then develop into paranoia that his entire family was against him. The easiest way to figure out whether your child was masturbating was if they were irreverent to their parents. If they, quote, spent most of the day leaning against a doorpost or wandering about in a vacant or abstracted way. Terrible. Sounds like a terrible time to be a teenager. Like one outburst and you're getting committed. You're getting the bodysuit, you know, the penis sheath. Edward Charles Spitka, a psychiatrist and author of Insanity, Its Classification, Diagnosis, and Treatment, which came out in 1883, also believed the youth were particularly afflicted with masturbation, especially one who lay in bed all day. Spitka had suggested that one patient, who was acting like a little bitch to his mother in the doctor's eyes, spend 2 months in a straitjacket in an asylum. Robert Baden Powell, who's the author of the 1908 Scouting for Boys and founder of the Scout movement, had declared that self-abuse led to degeneracy and that the best way to prevent said abuse was to wash the genitals in cold water every morning, then do as much exercise as possible to tire themselves out. While addressing a purity rally in 1910, the Irish Christian Sir Robert Anderson of the Criminal Investigation Department spoke, of a harrowing story of an Eton boy, son of a colonel in the army, a brilliant lad, always ahead of his class, who had been reduced to a driveling imbecile as the result of a secret sin, induced by the sight of an obscene photograph exhibited by a scoundrel whom he met in a railway train. End quote. The amount of anti-masturbation literature available peaked in 1900 and continued until about 1914. Most of the moralists in the second half of the 19th and early 20th century targeted upper and middle class boys in public school with little concern for anyone else. The bourgeois boy with nannies and servants was the future of the country, after all, and you can't have the nation's future leaders be a bunch of masturbating wimps. Edward Kirk, in his Talk with Boys About Themselves, which was published in 1905, declared dramatically that self-abuse, quote, will stunt your growth, soften your tissues, and wreck your health permanently. New sets of physicians began concentrating on how masturbation created mental problems, promoting a new term, masturbatory neurosis. The phrase was promoted by George Beard, Pierre Janet, and Jean-Martin Charcot, and Freud. Kraft, Ebbing, and Freud were also within the group who believed masturbating could cause neurosis or even psychosis, but British sexologist Havelock Ellis thought it was a symptom of a neurotic disorder. In Clinical Lectures of Mental Diseases, which came out in 1904, Thomas Smith Couston claimed, quote, habit of masturbation is very injurious to boys of neurotic temperament. John Harvey Kellogg, yes, that Kellogg, ran a sanatorium based on holistic treatment of nutrition, enemas, and exercise. His cereal, cornflakes, was made to be part of a healthy lifestyle and also aid in preventing masturbation by being extremely bland and tasteless and boring. He believed it caused insanity, personality changes, insomnia, indecision, confusion, acne, fear, pimples, shifty eyes, fits, and the use of obscenities. Female masturbators experienced the same symptoms, but also some additional ones like underdeveloped breasts, hysteria, jaundice, rickets, stomach cramps, womb ulcers, hermaphroditism, and sterility. His favorite preventative technique was to place electrodes in someone's rectum and urethra and mildly shock them. That was his preferred method to prevent masturbation. Preferred. Popular healers who prescribed for masturbatory ailments of the British failed to find a significant market in the U.S. before mid-century. But you know the story. First came Onania, then came physicians, then came the lecture, a culture war, and the horrifying suggestion that women masturbate. In case you haven't noticed, women haven't come up much so far. And I mean it when I say this, they genuinely could not fathom the idea that a woman would masturbate, let alone be horny. Onania, on top of bringing about hysteria about masturbation-induced insanity, also had the nerve to include women in its caution. Onania's author also included testimonial letters, and they were reprinted in each new edition. By 1717, there were 27 testimonials from men and 3 from women. But we have to remember that most of them, especially the ones from women, may have been fabricated. But even with female masturbation being acknowledged, it was alluded to in a lighthearted way and quickly dismissed. Tales of girls frolicking together in masturbatory bliss graced the pages of this controversial text. That was the image in men's minds, at least. There was one woman who we can't be sure even existed, quote, Mrs. E.O., described being enticed and showed the way, end quote, from other girls in her boarding school. All the play left her, quote, vehement desires for men unsatisfied. She married the first man who offered only to fatally exhaust him with, quote, delights of the marriage bed. Desperate, the young widow returned to her, quote, former wicked practice so often and with so much excess that I could hardly sometimes walk or sit with ease. I was so sore. Masturbation was such a masculine practice to Martin that he thought it could transform a clitoris into a penis. If only it were that easy. And he wasn't the only one. The Boston-based publisher who brought the colonial edition of Onania to the States failed to light a fire under the ass of the people like it did across the pond. And having learned that many considered Martin to be an obscene writer, a lot of the book ended up being censored. The juiciest parts, of course. And America instead focused heavily on self-mastery and the relationship between men and the masculine. Cotton Mather warned the young men of Massachusetts to not, quote, dishonor their own bodies alone by themselves in 1723. I mean, only someone with feminine leanings allowed their physical impulses to dictate their behavior. Every time a man masturbated, he invited an unclean spirit to take possession of him. What a bitch. American educators referenced Emile when arguing that boys needed disciplined instruction to help prepare them for the responsibilities of Republican manhood, which was defined by patriotism, stoicism, and eagerly participating in government politics. For women, masturbation caused nymphomania, satirism in men, which was intense sexual desire. In 1760, the Critical Review advised that furor uterinus, or raging female nymphomania, could be a result of masturbation. Women were especially vulnerable because they lacked the wherewithal to reason, which left their imagination riskily open. Ergo, masturbatory insanity. And I feel like that line of thinking is kind of a self-report. Like, outside of the whole women have two brain cells and need a strong logical man to lead them, lest they forget, like, to breathe or something, the fact that they could go insane from masturbating, like, to their fantasies, like, that intensely, like, buddy, you're lacking. you're lacking. I mean, obviously people masturbate for many reasons, not just that, but I just think it's funny. In 1833, women became central subjects in anti-masturbation physiology. Sexual physiology courses have now taken hold in America. The solitary vice, as they called it, became an issue of major concern when Sylvester Graham, muse for the famous s'more ingredient, started offering sexual advice to women and men, and the advice was not tailored for each group. They got the same speech. Allegedly. We don't know. We'll get into it. In December that same year, Graham was scheduled to speak in Providence, Rhode Island at a hall where an angry crowd had collected. His lecture, titled Lecture to Mothers on Sexual Physiology, had clearly struck a nerve. Illustrations of genital anatomy were on display, moderate sex advised, even within marriage, and worst of all, he warned them not to indulge in the solitary vice. And the problem here is he was acknowledging women. Right, extending the same logic of sexual restraint and responsibility, historically restricted only to men, put everyone on the same level. Addressing women as people capable of passion, of eroticizing the self, and restraint outraged men. Editors who called for a mob to run Graham out of Providence claimed that what had, quote, annoyed and exasperated the multitude was his decision to lecture to women only. The next summer in Portland, Maine, after an initial speech on chastity to men, a subsequent lecture on diet and regimen was given to a mixed gender audience. Two riots erupted because word got to the people that Graham planned to meet with unaccompanied married women in order to discuss, quote, reprehensible subjects. About 30 men and boys collected outside the building and threw rocks until the lecture was broken up. A small group of women had escorted a terrified Graham to safety, and the police persuaded rioters to leave. But as women gathered the next evening trying to listen to lecture to mothers, an even larger crowd was outside. Hundreds of men surrounded the building, shouting for Graham to, quote, pay 40 shillings and be hanged, without judge or jury, nay, without a hearing, end quote. Graham fled again, to the women's disappointment. A month later, Graham tried again in an attempt to uphold his commitment, but he was met with another riot from Portland men. He fled unharmed but terrified of the menacing men who publicly celebrated their control over public space and the women of their city. Graham figured it was lecture to mothers that was the source of his troubles, and he refused to repeat it for 3 years. In 1837, Graham tried to lecture to women in Boston, and this time, It was the largest and worst mob that had ever occurred for him. Mm-hmm. He claimed he only agreed to give the lecture because female organizers had rented the hall, sold tickets, and advertised it, quote, without consulting me and without my knowledge, end quote. The women arranged a second lecture despite warnings from the mayor and police marshal. And on the day, 300 onlookers gathered to witness the fun. 300 turned into more than 1,000. The next day, an even larger crowd burst into the Marlborough Hotel, reportedly, quote, maltreating Graham and forcing him to flee again. That man knows how to get the hell away from a situation. And Graham permanently retired the following year. He never published Lecture to Mothers, probably because of the riots. But the 1834 Lecture to Young Men was published. But there isn't even a transcript of Lecture to Mothers. Very sad. Graham wasn't always a lecturer on sexual physiology, though. He did give lectures, but worked as an agent for the Pennsylvania Society for Discouraging the Use of Ardent Spirits, where he traveled the state lecturing and fundraising. The shift happened when New York reformers invited Graham to lecture on physiology. He happily resigned from his agency to pursue, quote, a better destiny for which divine intelligence and purpose had all my life been training me. Take a shot every time I say lecture, you will die. There were women who recoiled at the thought of attending something with a mixed audience. Others warned he was vulgar, but enough sought out reform physiology. So Graham tested the waters and offered separate physiology courses. He refrained from the topic of sex, though, with women. Male audience members shared declarations of support, thanking Graham for alerting them to the dangers of masturbation and encouraged him to publish the lecture in order to save others. By the time he went on the tour that led him to that fateful day in Providence, Graham figured out segregated lectures on sexual physiology drew audiences, and violence and riots and newspapers dragging him. Two things convinced Graham to offer Lecture to Mothers in 1833. First, it was meeting male leaders during the initial stirrings of the moral reform movement and discovering, by traveling with them, that women in several cities demanded to be included in public discussions of sex. Second, he was competing with freethinkers or secular utopists whose physiology lectures disgusted Graham, and he felt freethinking philosophy was morally and medically dangerous. So he had to do it. He had to save the people. While in New York, Graham got friendly with John R. McDowell, notable for his anti-prostitution expose, The Magdalen Report. Graham linked McDowell's battle against the social vice, as he put it, of prostitution with his crusade against the solitary vice. To McDowell, no vice was, quote, so ruinous as lust. So now we have this shift, or, you know, this redefinition, where virtue is the rational suppression of one's desires, and you have vice, which is endangering the community in pursuit of personal gratification. Two fronts of a movement for a less horny America. You love to see it. Graham convinced several of McDowell's followers, who referred to themselves as the American Seventh Commandment Society, that simply refraining from illicit sex, read unmarried sex, married sex that didn't make a baby, or married sex for pleasure with others, was not enough in a society that catered to, quote, depraved sensuality. From Grant's perspective, avoiding masturbation cultivated bodily discipline, and one can strive for perfection through that. The virtue of restraint increases with difficulty. But, you know, you get an extra cookie if you resisted something that was really, really tempting. Graham and McDowell eventually joined forces, persuaded by each other's personal convictions, in Providence in the fall of 1833. In front of a mixed-gender audience, McDowell denounced social vice in all its iterations, prostitution being a big one, with Graham following and connecting the social with the solitary, the public with the private, by discussing, quote, indulgences of the most dangerous kind. And Graham's supporters quickly spread the gospel. Joseph Whitmarsh, J.N. Bowles, and T.T. Waterman organized Rhode Island's first moral reform society.
Others formed a gram association where members could assist one another in their pursuit of bodily virtue. The first of many physiological societies inspired by Graham and his philosophies. The Providence Association was also the last to include women. As a dynamic duo toured the Eastern Seaboard, local reformers created a number of societies where women were increasingly outnumbering men. The New York Female Reform Society was founded in May of 1834, partly to take charge of expansion, but they took over McDowell's journal for that purpose and renamed it the Advocate of Moral Reform in 1835. Female moral reformers warned young women with tales of seduction and abandonment to protect themselves from suitors who tried to pressure them into having premarital sex. Those who succumbed lost value in the eyes of their lovers, and once abandoned, slid inevitably into prostitution due to lost social standing and marriage prospects and needing to financially support themselves. And the only way to prevent more women from falling victim to such a tragic fate was to eliminate the double standard that upheld male dominance and female vulnerability. But there was a flip side. There was a binary, you know. If we have the moralist over here, we have the free thinkers over there. Freethinkers like Robert Dale Owen and Fanny Wright rested on the other side of the aisle and whipped Graham into a tizzy. Remember early, like, he was disgusted by people like this. The two would invite women into public lectures on sexual physiology. Those in Owen and Wright's camp celebrated pleasure and blamed Christian churches for forcing ignorance and repression upon a suffering public. Wright was a wealthy Scottish heiress and one of the most despised women in America because of her public lectures where she would argue that sexual passion was universal and that pleasure itself could be a positive force. She condemned the sexual double standard and critiqued marriage as a form of state-sanctioned prostitution. Above all, she argued that people should discover their own personal values and moral convictions through experience, rather than relying on religious authorities and husbands. Owen agreed with Wright, and in 1831 he published Moral Physiology, which was a pamphlet that described desire as a natural rise in temperature, and orgasm was necessary. It was helping to self-regulate the release of body heat. Which is interesting to me, and, like, I mean, it makes sense in a literal way, because, like, your body temperature literally goes up when you're masturbating and about to orgasm, right? And you're coming and your muscles tense up and spasm and your back is arching, all that, and then releases and relaxes and your body heat goes down. But alas, Owen echoed Onania and Tissot in labeling masturbation unhealthy. He said, quote, "For a vice so unnatural as onanism, there could be no possible temptation, and therefore no existence, were not men unnaturally and mischievously situated. It first appeared probably in monasteries and has been perpetuated by the more or less antisocial and demoralizing relation in which the sexes stand to each other in almost all countries. In estimating the consequences of the present false situation of society, we must set down to the black account the wretched, wretched consequences, terminating not unfrequently in incurable insanity, of this vice, the preposterous offspring of modern civilization. Physicians say that onanism at present prevails, to a lamentable extent, both in this country and in England. If the recommendations contained in this little treatise were generally followed, it would probably totally disappear in a single generation." What did he suggest? Well, sexual liberty. Not freedom within marriage, but freedom from marriage would prevent dangerous, quote, substitutions like onanism, prostitution, and sodomy. Owen also advocated for contraception so people could enjoy such freedoms and prevent pregnancy. He also mentions Madame Restelle in the pamphlet, which I thought was really cool, very wild. Anyway, other freethinkers like Charles Knowlton and Russell Canfield shared the same sexual philosophy and recommended douching as a contraceptive method. Moralists and freethinkers were in competition in New York and Philly for audiences, though the discourse of the former would eventually overwhelm the latter. But during, Graham viewed himself as the underdog, a victim, and blamed atheists for instigating the riots. But freethinkers failed to attract the audiences that reformed physiologists did. One anonymous woman reminisced several years later that she had made herself ill because of her masturbating habits before coming across Graham. Quote, "That blessed man, Dr. Graham, speak on this subject. Only then did she stop the wicked habit." Graham advised women on the solitary vice solely to equip them to instill sexual discipline in their sons and husbands. The title Lecture to Mothers on its surface signaled Republican motherhood, which was defined by the thought that women should be educated in order to properly fulfill her role as wife and mother and raise virtuous children. To them, being knowledgeable about sexual physiology was necessary in order to raise healthy, moral children. Republican motherhood emphasized a mother's duty to raise virtuous sons, who were future citizens and leaders of the nation. But Graham also made daughters targets of maternal surveillance. Quote, "Every mother ought to know that if her daughter should become so depraved as to practice self-pollution, they'd suffer the most calamitous evils." During the lecture, women could read between the lines and understand that Graham alluded to the fact that women's sexual desires and ability to practice restraint existed on a level above men's. These women and girls were people to be addressed as logical, rational, and capable of mastering their passions. He once quoted an author who suggested women experience stronger physical urges than men, since, quote, "woman has a larger reproductive system than man." Remember, the greater the temptation, the greater the virtue obtained by disciplining it. So if women experience stronger urges than men, those who mastered their desires and put those temptations on lock demonstrated not less passion, but more fortitude. They were the most virtuous. He also suggested that a woman giving into her desires could turn her into a lesbian, noting, quote, "Sappho indulged sexually with women. So did the women of Lesbos, and the habits of Sappho are called lesbian habits," end quote. Anyway. There was also a booming market of erotica, and masturbating women was a top seller. These books and images would be disguised as anti-masturbation advice, and Graham's haters despised him for exposing the wrong type of women to scenes of sapphism, nymphomania, and sexual commerce. It's one thing for a promiscuous woman to read and see those things, but what about the mothers? Female masturbation was one of the most prominent porn categories of the 18th and 19th centuries, but it was normally depicted in the context of a group sex scene with a central character eagerly awaiting her turn to flick the bean. Other times, she'd creep and yearningly watch a straight couple mess around through a window. A fantasy develops of this disembodied masturbating woman just absolutely ravenous with desire for a man to come and teach them to have sex with him on his terms. Female desire was acknowledged only in the sense that it centered a man. Male eyes, male bodies, and male will is all that it takes to rile up a woman who didn't know her own hunger. Thus, you have a fantasy born in which men possess an irresistible power to turn anybody, the virginest of virgins, into a whore. Throughout the 1830s, the Boston-based New England Galaxy, among other publications, and all three of its editors, William J. Schelling, John Neal, and Henry F. Harrington, attacked and ridiculed Graham's masculinity. Schelling explicitly argued that easy access to sexual pleasure was a masculine prerogative to which all white men were entitled. Harrington was a libertine and feared that Graham's obscene lectures destroyed the very femininity that made women desirable, that natural, quote, freedom from debasing passion. By the 1830s and 40s, the Moral Reform Network, mostly made up of rural white women, pushed the solitary vice from the country's margins to the cultural center, and by mid-century, it became America's central sexual obsession. It started when the Ladies Physiological Society of Boston started encouraging women to spread the word. These members formed hundreds of female moral reform societies throughout New England and upstate New York. Around 50,000 women joined these societies between 1835 and 1840, just in time to learn that, quote, "where social licentiousness has slain its thousands, solitary vice has slain its tens of thousands." The Boston Female Anti-Slavery Society also made a strong showing at the ill-fated lecture. The biracial organization of abolitionists joined leaders in the Boston Female Moral Reform Society in resisting the mob. Black women such as Hannah C. Cutler, Louisa Drummond, Elizabeth White, and Mrs. Lewis York, among others, made up a tenth of Graham's Boston audience. We know these women's names because they signed a defense of Lecture to Mothers, in which they too claim rights as ladies and citizens. Black abolitionists of Boston had invited Graham to lecture at the Adelphi Union, which was a peer education institution. Graham's lectures on the science of human life never excluded Black people, and the physiology course drew such a large crowd that the audience had to move to a larger space. He didn't deliver Lecture to Mothers, so Black women had to attend the lecture on sexual physiology among an audience of majority white women. But Black women who gathered to discuss sex across the color line still risked violence. Newspaper editors named Graham's attendees, quote, females of the abolition faith, and made of, quote, 26 ladies of color. The threat of amalgamation, a term used to refer to interracial intimacy, was used as a tool of suppression. Amalgamation riots were happening with increasing frequency during the 1830s, and often followed a recognizable pattern of an intentional flooding of rumors of amalgamation to provoke white male readers into attacking anti-slavery meetings, as shown by William L. Stone of New York Commercial Advertiser and James Watson Webb of Courier and Enquirer. Threat of mob violence was usually enough for lecture hall owners to ban an anti-slavery meeting on their property, but when the anti-slavery societies would meet anyway, the speakers would often be assaulted by having rotten eggs and stones thrown at them. City authorities and firefighters would claim they simply just couldn't prevent rioters from burning buildings, destroying printing presses, and wounding and murdering people that had the nerve to protest racism and exist together. Black abolitionists utilized the language of female moral reformers in cautious hopes of bridging the two movements, something that racists feared. Rioters claimed to be protecting white feminine innocence, but really, they just hated to see solidarity. Like when an 1840 mob attacked a Grahamite boarding house, smashing the windows and dragging out an Ohio abolitionist and beating him severely. This was in reaction to a news report that one of the abolitionists, quote, a very pretty white girl, had made a show of approaching a black man and flirtatiously reaching into his pocket to find the time. Black abolitionists also equated licentiousness with slavery and racist exploitation in the North, considering that female moral reformers aimed to abolish licentiousness in all forms. Another priority of Black activists and abolitionists was subverting racist stereotypes of Black sexuality. Conceiving licentiousness as something not just in terms of sexual excess, but also excessive sexual power, which was highlighting the social license that allowed white men to take sexual liberties. And for Black women, those liberties were committing an unfathomable amount of sexual violence. Black women's moral reform efforts weren't a bid for respectability in white eyes, but they did work to challenge white moral reform women and push them to confront the racialized dimensions of the sexual double standard. Virtue is then being redefined in a space of moral accountability rather than passive chastity. Northern white women were at the forefront of anti-masturbation physiology between 1837 and 1845. They rallied for temperance and dietary restraint and the abandonment of tightly laced corsets. In 1839, Mary Gove, who was a prominent female lecturer of the movement, released Solitary Vice as a pamphlet. 3 years later, her book Lectures to Ladies came out filled to the brim with devastating testimonials. Women who attended physiology lectures focused more intensely on their own sexuality. Gove had handpicked cases from women of her audience, but she assured readers she'd received testimonials only from, quote, the most conscientious and worthy ladies of the first respectability. The retellings, while including how it made them insane and extremely ill, urging physicians to do more against the solitary vice and thanking Graham, showed that even the most devout person that you knew was likely masturbating, flicking the bean, you know, as they say. Gove mentioned, quote, diseases which are caused by this habit were for everyone and listed a litany of consequences, including spinal disease, headache, epilepsy, impaired eyesight, lung bleeding, sudden death. Tellings of intimate encounters appear to be more influential than the lectures on solitary vice, and as time went on, the moral reform movement was pushed further away from its original external gaze and moved more internally. Moral reformers relished in renouncing the solitary vice. It felt so good to talk about just how virtuous you were. White female sexuality is morphing and is now being characterized by denial of personal desire and virtue that comes from that. Anti-masturbation discourse shifted around 1845, and women leaders of the female moral reform movement became self-appointed guardians. Motherhood was always a central tenet in discussions on the solitary vice, but during the 1840s, reformers named it as the primary reason for women to discuss it at all. Speaking about sexual physiology was justified so the woman could be a better parent. In 1847, white female reformers organized Philadelphia's Rosine Association, which was a philanthropic society that ran an asylum, quote, for the reformation, employment, and instruction of females whose habits and situation have precluded them from the sympathies and respect of the virtuous part of the community. Mind you, Black Philadelphians were intentionally excluded, despite hundreds of Black people petitioning the Rosine Association to admit, quote, colored children to the House of Refuge. Believing white girls and women to be inherently pure, the faux guardians blamed their prostitution on deficient education, the want of proper remuneration for services, and the neglect of suitable maternal and sympathizing care. It's simply not their fault they became whores. Black women, though, I don't know, they're just like that. These guardians assumed a role of surrogate mom, imparting their feminine virtues of sexual restraint through physiology lectures. Teachers at the Rosine Association taught students about the dangers of masturbation as a gateway to promiscuity, just like weed. Moral guardians also spread anti-masturbation discourse through missionary operations, for one, believing the solitary vice to be practiced at, quote, an alarming extent among the children, members of the New England Female Moral Reform Society sent copies of Friend of Virtue with a missionary named Mrs. Thurston to her school in Hawaii, whose natives pre and a little after contact with colonists were very open-minded about masturbation. But as it was mentioned earlier, not everyone vibed with the whole passionless sex, no pleasure, make baby stuff. Frederick Hollick, who was a British immigrant, gained notoriety in the mid-19th century as a purveyor of sexual knowledge. His lectures were graphic. They elicited outrage and accusations of obscenity, no surprise there, but he also gained some strong support. He claimed to have lectured upward of 39,000 people and reached even more through book sales, with later editions being translated in Spanish. His appeal came from encouraging his audience to interpret his words in whatever way they saw fit. On one hand, he depicted female bodies as voracious, orgasmic, and that was attractive to libertine Republicans as it ultimately painted women perpetually dependent on men for pleasure. But on the other, Hollick promoted contraception and marriage reform, which appealed to many women who wanted an alternative to moral reformers' fears of sexual danger. But don't get too happy, because he definitely spread the idea that masturbation caused illnesses and insanity and death. Hollick was part of a growing print culture that celebrated pleasure for pleasure's sake and maintained Onania's claim that limiting, quote, healthy intercourse drove people to masturbation and all its dangers. Hollick labeled his pro-pleasure ethos as the philosophy of omitive indulgence. Women embraced physiology lectures and books, searching for instructions on female pleasure within the confines of having a penis involved, and rejecting the old moral reform goal of, quote, crucifying sexual desire. Hollick's book, Marriage Guide, became a hit upon release, and it contained contraceptive advice, described the location and function of the clitoris, and advised readers how to achieve mutual orgasm through penetrative sex. And that was like the ultimate goal back then, ultimate goal. We're going to get into it. The law inevitably did catch up with Hollick, who was prosecuted for obscene libel in Philly during the spring of 1846. The sexual double standard was a focal point of the case. According to the leading men of the city, it was one thing to describe insatiably orgasmic women in print for a male audience, completely different to lecture to women on the pleasures of sex. And the grand jury's task was to determine whether or not his book, The Origin of Life, which was a compilation of his lectures, constituted a libel on the community. On March 17, 1846, Hollick was indicted for obscene libel. The bill of indictment specifically listed the words penis and vagina as obscene, and it was especially obscene when the words were used together, like they were in Origins in the section on marital advice. The prosecutor, William Dar Kelly, deemed it a libel on the community when uttered before ladies. But Hollick's attorney, J.G. Clarkson, basically said that Hollick was a science writer for Pete's sake, and as such, his use of the correct terms for genitals fell in line with the necessity to use them by informing readers that these organs belong together, by showing the wholesomeness of straight people having some damn good sex together, to contrast the lethal solitary vice. The book uplifted the moral tone of the community. Wherever one fell on the issue, it was clear that the center of these debates on the lectures was a question of women's right to hear them. Sexual topics spoken from a man's lips to her ears. His defenders embraced his philosophy of amative indulgence. It's moderation, not chastity, that serves as the foundation of the laws of life and health. Women's rights advocates like Lydia Maria Child, Mary Child, and Paulina Wright Davis shifted to a pursuit of sexual virtue during the late 1840s. So now there's a focus on one's ability to indulge in moderation rather than complete repression of sexual impulses, and that was true virtue. Masturbation was framed as an inherently immoderate thing. Secret. No partner required. Gateway to addiction. But now, pleasure could exist while still spreading the idea that masturbation will taint your body and mind and kill you. Through anatomical texts, black women's bodies were also presented as inherently immoderate. White women who consumed these texts defended their interest in sexual physiology as a sign of, quote, true delicacy and a really pure taste, with false delicacy being refraining from discussing racy topics like sex in pursuit of appearing virtuous. Hollick developed his philosophy as a teen in his hometown of Birmingham, England, while working as a silversmith's apprentice. He attended Freethought lectures and embraced the teachings of Robert Owens. He later became a secular missionary and argued against state religion. He insisted that neither church nor state could or should govern one's sexual conduct. Only the sacred individual, male or female, married, unmarried, could properly do so. He considered pleasure to be a net good and agreed with Fanny Wright that conventional marriage particularly disadvantaged women. He also subscribed to the belief that frequent sexual pleasure was a physiological necessity for all adults. Sexual pleasure ennobled humanity. Quote, the higher any being is placed in the scale of creation, the more multiplied are its means of enjoyment, and the more intense those enjoyments become. Sex was a wholesome surplus energy when the vital functions are too active. So women starved of an orgasm suffered severe nervous afflictions, as proposed by Hollick. Hollick, the man that he is, instructed men on the importance of clitoral stimulation, lubrication, and timing. He was particularly passionate in his argument that the most rapturous experience of all, and should be pursued as such, was simultaneous orgasm. Which is funny to me because I remember that being so important back then. Like, it was always shown in movies and media as like the pinnacle of love, and like, this is it, like, this is perfect, like, this is how sex is supposed to be, like, this is how you know you're supposed to be with someone. And I don't really see it come up anymore. Like, it's not really shown anymore, which I think is interesting. But it's just crazy that that carried on for so long. But anyway, Hollick, like the Grahamites and moral reformers, described desire as universal and validated women as sexual beings. But alas, he too deemed the solitary vice the master evil of the present day. Such a shame. For him, it was because it depleted the nervous system. Men who overindulged would lose their powers. And an unmarried, childless woman orgasming on her own, well, she could lose her passion for men and turn into a lesbian. Then what? Men have now become responsible for preventing masturbation in women by skillfully making them come. You want to stop women from masturbating?
be better at having sex with them. I think they need to bring that back. They need to bring this back expeditiously, because the orgasm gap shouldn't even exist, but it does. And you know who's losing out on that. Hollick's book seemed to teach youth of both sexes the intricacies of vicious indulgences. And like its predecessors, the masturbation chapter could be interpreted as instructions, and some interpreted it as such. That was the case with news editor Charles Alexander and his critique of Hollick, saying, quote, "Beware the Trojan horse." In Hollick's chapter, this is what he said. This was, you know, what was interpreted. The genital organs become highly sensitive. This produces slight irritation and uneasiness, to relieve which the hand is directed to them, the friction of which produces a new and pleasant sensation before unknown. When once this has been experienced, the desire to create it again becomes irresistible, and with each new indulgence, the habit strengthens and becomes more confirmed. End quote. What do y'all think? Right around this time, there was a dramatic rise of proprietary healers claiming to have the ability to treat the destructive habit. It was really just an offshoot of the long-standing trade of, like, selling abortifacients and, like, cures for venereal diseases. And Hollick seemed to contribute to this growing industry, and he was even accused by the Daily Chronicle of being a quack, noting his private consultation room for the ladies, end quote, in the museum that he lectured at. And he used to sell indica through the mail as an aphrodisiac. Fun fact. But it was known that women could pay for sex therapy from a number of various practitioners in Philadelphia. There was Dr. Hunter, who invited either sex to his private rooms on 7th Street to cure, quote, "those who have injured themselves by solitary vice." Then there was John Fondley, who ran a separate office on the same street. He sold electromagnetic instruments for men and women who experienced, quote, "diseases of excess or onanism." And then there was another seller in Philly named Arnold R. Kinklin, and he and his wife Augustina operated a medical house. It had private consultation rooms for men and women, and having long treated sufferers of syphilis and gonorrhea, by 1846, the couple had expanded their services to, quote, "persons who, by indulging in a secret habit, have entailed on themselves constitution debility." Hollick initially saw patients in the museum or at the Sanderson Hotel where he was staying at, but consultation proved lucrative, and he was able to rent a long-term office on Sansom Street. Now, if the recommended regimen and medications failed, the ex-masturbator could purchase electrotherapy or the shampoo, which was a genital massage. And if that failed, the client could apply for therapy with a special suction device that Hollick called the congester, which promised to restore the sexual powers to even the most damaged organs, we're crossing in some freaky territory, a little bit, just a little bit. But him selling these services to women made people so upset that they just glossed over the fact that he was, like, if a man, like, paid for these services, like, he was offering hand jobs. No one clocked that. They had a single focus. Now, the chapter in Hollick's origin on solitary vice would have reminded some libertines of other books that warned against onanism with a wink while fetishizing masturbating women. There was Leopold Delon's treatise on the diseases produced by onanism, which was originally published in Paris in 1835, but it arrived in America in 1845. He wrote that masturbation masculinized women and feminized men, writing, "Onanists rendered themselves effeminate and demoralized their constitution by using these parts in such a manner as to fatigue and change them, and to observe women robbing themselves in the same manner of their beauty, the delicacy of their form, and the charm of their voice." Later, he wrote about ravenous women who couldn't help but masturbate so fervently and intensely, having to be tied up or held or examined by a physician. And then there was also William Greenfield's The Secret Habits of the Female Sex, which was addressed to the young solitarian, clearly targeting horny men, within itself cures for syphilis and condom ads. And more reformers warned one another not to fall for it. It was published anonymously or with a pseudonym of Jean Dubois. And of course, it was the subject of many obscenity prosecutions.
Hollick's friend T.B. Peterson, who was acquainted with the other two, had published and sold erotic books like Wildness of Woman, History of a Flirt, The Beautiful French Girl, The Divorced, and The Ensnared, A Story of Woman's Heart. Though his better-known productions included a salacious, anti-Catholic, awful Disclosures of Maria Monk in 1836. But alas, alas, you just can never get too comfortable with these people. You start to like them a little bit, you agree with something that they're saying, and then you find something else out. Hollick was fiercely racist, anti-abolition, and anti-amalgamation. He argued black slaves fared better than white wage workers, and that interracial marriage was a tool to, quote, destroy all distinction between the races. He has stated that mixed kids were destined by, quote, physical deformity and mental imbecility. Though it may have been for show, because this was like before he popped off with the physiology lectures, but he never, repudiated anti-slavery women who came forward to defend him. But I don't trust it. I mean, cause either way, he was still being racist for a check, and that's crazy. Sex education in America was born out of the female moral reform movement's physiological crusade against the solitary vice. Sarah Mapps Douglas, a black teacher at the Quaker-owned Institute for Colored Youth, which was funded by white philanthropists, had a line to toe when teaching physiology. Though it was necessary, it still posed risk in a social context that maligned all black women with those same harmful sexual stereotypes. These risks intensified during the early 1850s when Douglas started teaching sexual physiology to her students and adult women at the Institute. Douglas had provided useful info for sexual protection, health, and enjoyment while constructing a distinction between innate purity and sexual virtue. White reformers focused on eliminating the solitary vice, and by the 1850s, two camps had emerged out of this, right? One camp was promoting purity by preventing kids from experiencing any type of sexual desire, and the other was basically saying virtuous women need to practice moderation, right? You still have sexual rights, but that requires solitary restraint and amative indulgence. That was that. You can guess how well that went. Around this time, lectures on sexual physiology were presumed to include life-saving warnings against masturbation. Douglas was raised in a prosperous household of activists and enjoyed educational opportunities that were unavailable to most antebellum black people. She attended a school co-founded by her mother, Bastille Douglas, and black abolitionist James Forten. To Douglas, her privilege was a debt to her peers, and teaching was her means of repayment. A female medical movement had started to take shape around the 1850s, around the same time, with participants claiming their right to practice medicine. Elizabeth Blackwell was the first woman to earn a medical degree in the United States in 1849, and after Harvard had rejected Harriet Keziah Hunt, who had been practicing since 1835, she publicized the injustice at the first Women's Rights Convention in 1850. The two had inspired a generation of women who were unsatisfied by the moral guidance and regimented advice offered by physiology lecturers. Medical feminists demanded the kind of education that would prepare them for employment, not just motherhood and spousal support. Activists had insisted that medical practice would benefit from women's special understanding of the body. And as a result, reformers created medical colleges for women in Boston in 1848, Philly in 1850, and the Female Medical College of Pennsylvania awarded Hunt and Blackwell with honorary medical degrees in 1853. Both women gave lectures on the locus of life early in their careers, and, you know, they denounced licentiousness and warned against masturbation and promoted healthy sources of pleasure. Douglas had been attending courses to become a physician at the Female Medical College of Pennsylvania, and it also exposed her to the sexual politics of white women, including the debates over the nature of female desire, which had also just gone into two camps, with medical reformers on one hand basically saying feminine purity needs to be protected, and the other saying women and men are equally horny, and the latter half encouraging lecture listeners to define virtue for themselves.
Mid-century medical feminists continued with the moral trajectory of reformed physiology and stressed obedience to a set of divine, quote, laws of life, and declared the solitary vice was a violation of the body's proper government. On physiology, reformers existed on a spectrum. Radicals or free lovers like Mary Gov Nichols and her second husband Thomas Lowe Nichols fought against coverture laws, which legally made the wife an extension of her husband rather than a separate person, advocated for voluntary motherhood and female sexual pleasure with a man. Thomas celebrated the female ability to have, quote, 6 or 7 orgasms in rapid succession, each seeming to be more violent and ecstatic than the last. The other half absolutely hated the free love movement, like Hunt and Blackwell, who argued that sex, quote, in a union without love, or where all the enjoyment is on one side, caused disease in women. Blackwell informed women, quote, there is nothing necessarily evil in physical pleasure, for righteous use brings renewed and increasing satisfaction to the two made one in harmonious union, end quote. Liberal, radical, they all still did not fuck with masturbation. Everyone basically said it was a sin. It's a crime against nature. And it's a foil for healthy, straight sex. Thomas L. Nichols, the husband, had deemed sodomy, quote, less hurtful than the far more common practice of solitary vice. Sex radicals and medical feminists agreed on one thing. The most dangerous aspect of masturbation was that it destroyed the natural desire of one sex for the other. Nichols argued that it, quote, transferred sexual sensation from the vagina to the clitoris in women, and Blackwell told her students that, quote, erectile tissue, mostly internal, was the direct seat of a special sexual spasm. Blackwell summarized, love between the sexes is the highest and mightiest form of human sexual passion. And Douglas applied the tenets of these physiology debates and everything that she learned from university and the lectures and participated in the nation's first wave of sex education in public schools. The movement of moral reform utilized this newly widespread fear of masturbation to advocate for laws mandating physiology as part of the public school curriculum. The idea that adult women needed to learn physiology in order to avoid the consequences of masturbation was extended to children during the same time period in the 1850s, and it bolstered the argument in support of sex education. After more than a decade of imploring mothers to teach their children self-restraint and virtue, basically teach your kids not to masturbate, leaders of the women's moral reform movement had concluded that state intervention was the only way to achieve that goal. Women's medical colleges vehemently supported legislation that would require teachers to pass a physiology exam before they entered the classroom. But first, to get those measures passed, reform women needed to convince politicians, who were men, that investment in female medical colleges and training served the people. This was achieved by reviving the link between masturbation and insanity. And before the 1850s, most antebellum physicians were a bit skeptical about that link in the first place, but moral reformers have been pushing the masturbation-lunatic connection since the early 1830s. There was intensified focus on the neurological aspect after 1836, when the interests of the reformers reflected those of a self-promoting asylum superintendent named Samuel B. Woodward. Woodward had named masturbation as the second leading cause of insanity among patients of the Worcester Lunatic Asylum that same year. In his essay, Hints for the Young, Woodward suggested that the youth could be prevented from being, quote, reduced to idiocy through education. Woodward's work was distributed across the Northeast by reformers who were also lobbying state officials like Horace Mann of Massachusetts, who was the pioneer of the common school system, and the state's Secretary of Education. Reformers had pushed for Mann to redirect funds from asylum building to professional training for women to become teachers. Mann also firmly believed that the solitary vice, which to him, too many educators were silent about, gave birth to insanity directly.
The strategy of medical feminists involved trying to convince politicians and voters that public investment in physiological education would save taxpayers money by reducing the need for asylums. Masturbation harm reduction, if you will. In 1850, the Massachusetts General Court passed the act requiring qualifying exams in physiology for all teachers. The law read, "Be enacted by the State and House of Representatives in General Court assembled and by the authority of the same as follows. Section 1. Physiology and hygiene shall hereafter be taught in all the public schools of this Commonwealth in all cases in which the school committee shall deem it expedient. Section 2. All school teachers shall hereafter be examined in their knowledge of the elementary principles of physiology and hygiene and their ability to give instructions in the same." End quote. Sex education in America is born. Teacher training and instruction could propagate a specific vision of feminine purity and virtuous pleasure with a man. Most important of all was that it prevented the, quote, insanity, idiocy, and various other physical infirmities. Local school committees would enforce compliance with Massachusetts physiology law and expected teachers to appropriately guide their students on the dangers of masturbation. In 1858, inspectors in the town of Boxford had chastised local teachers who had failed to teach physiology, reminding them that the law required them to impart, among other virtues, chastity. In Sturbridge, the townspeople believed that even the youngest of the youth could understand, quote, the great laws of human existence, the violation of which produces disease, suffering, and death. Massachusetts had inspired other states to follow in their footsteps in subsequent decades. And when Pennsylvania passed its own law in 1881, the Institute for Colored Youth had already churned out generations of black teachers equipped to teach physiology. Educators still placed masturbation in the realm of the unnatural, of the weird, which worked to promote abstinence of or wholesome intercourse within marriage. And this was well into the 20th century. Douglas's students at the Institute for Colored Youth read Calvin Cutter's Anatomy, and the author was an abolitionist and supported mandatory sex education. Douglas worked to deconstruct stereotypes that harmed black women by blending anti-masturbation and sexual frankness and racial affirmation into her lessons. And she did this by using her own drawings of exotic flowers as a metaphor for black female vulvas. In Douglas's eyes, quote, self-abuse included a false delicacy that could prevent her students from learning how to control their fertility, heal STIs, and exercise informed virtue. She encouraged her students to treat their own bodies as theirs alone to govern. In 1877, Rebecca Cole became the first black woman to graduate with a medical degree from Female Medical College, Pennsylvania, and filled in Douglas's shoes, performing the duties of her predecessor as principal of the Institute for Colored Youth, including teaching physiology, preventative medicine, and hygiene. Medicalizing masturbation pitted solitary deviance against a naturalized and empowering view of male-centered female pleasure. God, we've come so far. But anti-masturbation discourse slowly reverted to its earlier concern with young men and their wanking habits. After the American publication of Claude-François Lalemant's thesis on spermatorrhea, the widespread concern over youthful masturbation primarily focused on young boys. By 1860, solitary vice turned into a problem of onanism. An entire population of boys in their youth who now required intimate relations with women. White feminists had also disregarded the distinction between purity and virtue, something they and their black comrades had previously made. The advent of neurology and sexology had eroded the discourse on masturbatory insanity, and it was already a term that physicians weren't even really using until the 1860s. Excessive masturbation was increasingly seen as a symptom of pre-existing mental illness and not a cause. And critics had been disparaging Woodward's asylum data as unscientific and backward. By the turn of the 20th century, women who worked in the asylum began to doubt the reality of masturbatory insanity.
Between 1890 and 1908, Clara Barris, the physician in charge of women at the Middletown, New York State Homeopathic Hospital, had flip-flopped between the antebellum assumption that self-government was necessary for a healthy state of mind and the modern skepticism that masturbation could ever in itself sufficiently explain insanity. She was especially concerned that family members used the diagnosis of masturbatory insanity to disempower ambitious or unruly daughters by having them committed, which we all know was already happening. When she did occasionally treat for masturbation in the common areas of the asylum, she refused to use the recommended padded mitts, restraining of hands and feet, and the protection sheet. Barris considered these tools beyond useless. The British sexologist Havelock Ellis had quoted Barris in his book Autoeroticism, which was published in 1899, and it detailed a history of masturbation. Ellis has surmised that psychological damage was not caused by masturbation, but by what he saw as, quote, ignorant and chaotic notions among the general population. He still proposed that excess masturbation led to nervous exhaustion and created an aversion to normal coitus in women. And he wrote that women might very reasonably prefer masturbation over what was normal coitus because they, quote, experience greater difficulties than men in obtaining sexual satisfaction and so are impelled by unsatisfying coitus to continue masturbation after marriage. It's interesting because those sentiments carried on with sex toys and this whole paranoia about independent women not needing a man for anything anymore, not even for pleasure, and like, you know, are men obsolete now? And but female patients and case studies actually suggested that masturbation was possibly beneficial. One woman exclaimed, quote, I felt that I should go mad, and I thought it was better to touch myself than to be insane. The social worker, Dr. Catherine Davis, revealed a reality that differed from physicians and moralists when it came to female masturbation. She was employed by the Bureau of Social Hygiene to interview 2,200 white women's college alumnae and found that they liked to masturbate just as frequently as men. The results were published in 1929 in Factors in the Sex Life of 2,200 Women. Several of the women blamed masturbation for, quote, increased nervousness, half reported no bad effect, and only one associated masturbation with, quote, dread of insanity, which I consider a win. Desire for full satisfaction and, you know, to avoid long periods of sexual starvation were also listed as reasons that these women played downstairs DJ. Half of the interviewees were married, half of them weren't. And the number who admitted that they masturbated frequently since marriage was nearly as large as men. Nearly 65% of unmarried women and 40% of the married ones admitted to masturbating, but 2/3 of them did think it was degrading. Alfred Kinsey's surveys in the 50s further shocked the public when it was revealed that it was common for men and women to masturbate, married too. 92% of men and 62% of women. The youth tended to have an inclination for it, and it tapered off in middle age, but this was the inverse for women, which is so interesting. Around the same time, black progressives rejected any act that could threaten the mental or physical health of black people. William Hannibal Thomas and Dr. A. Wilberforce Williams linked masturbation to syphilis and racial degeneration. In Williams' words, quote, chronic self-abusers gave birth to idiots, epileptics, imbeciles, and the hopelessly insane. Black socialites and hygiene instructors at black colleges also condemned the act. Angelina Weld Grimke, who was the daughter of a black biracial man, Archibald Grimke, protested that racial violence damaged black women's sexual and reproductive health far more than masturbation or promiscuity. Oh, I love black women. Always 8 steps ahead. But black radicals of the early 20th century didn't present masturbation as a radical act of declaring sexual autonomy and erotic rights like their counterparts. Black women had turned away from the white reform women who continued to conflate normal feminine sexuality with whiteness. But of course, the tides change eventually. A German doctor named Emil Kraepelin was the first to prove masturbation didn't cause insanity in 1896 from research he conducted in asylums. In 1929, the author Rossi Husted Bell declared, quote, according to clinical data, according to the plainest common sense, masturbation is no more harmful than the cooperative act between mates.
The German psychologist Wilhelm Steckel, who was a contemporary of the famed American Alfred Kinsey, took a firm stance against masturbation haters. He condemned traditional beliefs about masturbation and opposed the idea that it caused anxiety and depression or in any way promoted suicide. And he demanded an alleviation of religious and social pressures and encouraged the belief that masturbation was good for personal health and happiness. By 1968, a new generation of feminists were exploring erotic liberation as a microcosm of women's liberation. They rejected Freud's characterization of clitoral orgasms as infantile and argued that the real infantilization occurred in having women believe their sexual awakening relied on a man that they longingly waited for. Armed with physiological studies that proved clitoral stimulation was a healthy part of women's sexual expression, they quickly launched a campaign to normalize masturbation. And then it became a symbol of female independence and self-love. The famed feminist Betty Dodson found that the presumption of sexual innocence was so unhealthy for women, and she founded the Body Sex Workshops, in which groups of women masturbated and orgasmed together in community. In feminist thought, women weren't taught how to masturbate and thus remained dependent. Dodson aimed to remedy this by distributing images of the vulva, selling vibrators, and providing live demonstrations that would sometimes turn into women's only orgies. By the mid-70s, masturbation was considered pretty normal socially. One woman enthused, quote, "Masturbation gave me the knowledge I could achieve orgasm. Now I know I'm normal," end quote. Lonnie Barback, who was a sex therapist and created pre-orgasmic women's groups, argued that consciousness raising just wasn't enough. To Lonnie, group members needed, quote, "peer pressure and group reinforcement to overcome the stigma of masturbation." Karen Sandler, who experienced orgasmic ecstasy at one of these group meetings, felt tempted to, quote, "rent a billboard on Wilshire Boulevard with, 'I came, I came, I came,' in big red letters." That's so sweet. I think that's a pretty beautiful thing, to feel like a part of you has been released or freed, or, you know, like just feeling so empowered by having this knowledge and ability to make yourself come, especially as an adult. If you've like gone a majority of your life, like from when, even when you're sexually active and never having experienced something as like wonderful as an orgasm, especially through partnered sex, I can imagine that anyone would feel like pretty powerful and reawakened upon like having their first orgasm, and it's due to masturbation, like they gave themselves that. I think it's great. While feminists of color tackled issues of sexual violence, reproductive justice, poverty, and public health, Black feminists also revolutionized sex on their own terms. Sex, eroticism, sexuality, and desirability exist in a completely different context for Black women. And so for them, revolutionizing sex on their own terms included autoerotic writing like that of Audre Lorde and Alice Walker. But there was also a culture war going on between feminists, something that we still hear and see today. What does it mean to be sex radical? Could something as seemingly inconsequential as masturbation really be a tool in women's liberation? What about porn? According to Horfin Spillers, while expressing caution amidst discourse between anti-porn feminists and their sex-positive peers, feminism shouldn't stop at sexual counter-discourse. Quote, "Feminists must pursue a global restoration and dispersal of power. In pursuit of such a goal, sex would be rendered one of several active predicates." In wider society, the battle raged on between those who wanted to protect women's sexual innocence and those hoping to empower them to make their own sexual choices. In 1994, Surgeon General Joycelyn Elders was fired by then-President Bill Clinton, over the phone, I might add, after it was reported that she believed masturbation, quote, "perhaps should be taught to school children at an AIDS forum." The comment came about during a discussion of AIDS prevention. She was asked by an audience member about the prospects that masturbation could be more openly discussed and promoted as a means of keeping young people from riskier sexual activity. Elders was a pediatric endocrinologist before joining Clinton's team as Arkansas Health Secretary, and I made it clear from the beginning of her term that she intended to promote widespread school-based sex education and services to teens. That included contraceptive availability. She also said she'd advocate freedom of choice in abortion and suggested the nation study legalizing drugs as a way to reduce crime. Quote, I think it is something that's part of human sexuality and is part of something that perhaps should be taught, but we've not even taught our children the very basics. And I feel that we have tried ignorance for a very long time, and it's time we try education. Backlash was swift and strong, with Clinton saying that Elders' comments reflect, quote, differences with the administration policy and my own convictions, and I've made it necessary for her to tender her resignation. 2 years later, in 1996, Clinton had signed the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Act into law. In addition to, quote, ending welfare as we've known it, the new law had slated $50 million annually in federal funds for states whose school systems promoted abstinence, which is so helpful, so helpful and effective. Unless you haven't been born yet, you can guess that things continued to shift as the people were ushered into the 21st century. In a 2007 national survey of the British, it was discovered that among people aged 16 to 44, 95% of men and 71% of women had masturbated at some point in their lives, and 73% of men and 37% of women had reported participating in the solo demonstration in the 4 weeks before their interview. A 2009 leaflet titled Pleasure, published on behalf of the Sheffield National Health Service in England and aimed at British teens, promoted masturbation as a healthy alternative to the risk of sexual diseases in teen pregnancy. Its slogan, an orgasm a day keeps the doctor away. America literally could never. The authors had felt that experts had concentrated too much on safe sex and committed relationships for too long, while ignoring the main reason why people have sex in the first place. A U.S. survey of sexual health and behavior in 2012 found that 92% of straight men and 100% of gay men who had responded reported masturbating in their lifetime. In analyzing around 600 masturbation scenes in film and TV, Lauren Rosewarne, who authored Masturbation in Pop Culture, which was published in 2014, found that female masturbation was typically depicted in an erotic tone and fashion, but male masturbation was almost always shown negatively, especially as something humorous. We've been freed and we can all masturbate till our fingers fall off, right? Well, they had insanity in the past, then it was no morals, no virtue, and now? Well, now there's a soft association with masturbation, typically male masturbation, and an unhealthy relationship with porn and grossness. And now there's NoFap. The NoFap forum on Reddit currently has over 1 million users and is the most visible semi-anti-masturbation community online. It was originally founded in 2011 by Alexander Rhodes, who is a Pittsburgh web developer and the first to make a post on Reddit about the topic. The NoFap website describes itself as, quote, a porn addiction and compulsive sexual behavior recovery peer support forum. The negative impacts of porn, like compulsive masturbation, have been studied. A 2018 survey by the relationship charity Relate found that 47% of therapists saw an increase in the number of clients saying porn was causing problems in their sex lives. Nearly a quarter of those issues were directly related to erectile dysfunction and other performance issues. NoFap doesn't consider itself anti-porn or anti-masturbation, but it aims to provide support to people who'd like to return to their pre-porn selves. Some members of the forum believe in physical benefits, referencing Mike Tyson and Muhammad Ali and Steve Jobs, who would all abstain from ejaculating in preparation for major events in their lives and to conserve energy. Belief in the health benefits of semen retention also include renewed energy, greater focus, concentration, and better sleep. But there's little medical evidence of these claims. Young men have encountered inaccurate science and misogynistic rhetoric while trying to abstain from masturbation, but many posts within the forum and beyond have been fertile ground to be ensnared into incel forums while searching for community and support. Sex education programs of prior decades have aimed to protect the sexual innocence and virtue and morals of America's youth through abstinence-only education, promoting purity, and celebrating female virginity. It all starts at the personal. If you want to keep yourself pure, don't touch yourself. And like physiology education demanded by school committees, abstinence-only teaching materials describe masturbation as a gateway to further sexual experimentation, which would in turn cause disease. I don't know about y'all, But the sex education I received as an adolescent and teen, like, stressed the same points and fears. That leads to generations of children to understand sex, sexuality, and their bodies through a lens of shame and guilt and worth around behaviors that are completely normal and healthy to explore, leaving people unequipped and ignorant of something as simple as masturbation, and their body leaves them vulnerable, not to a life of deviancy and seizures and acne and death, but to people with ill intentions who look forward to taking advantage of that naivete. But as you can see, just like any other historical topic, there's plenty of nuance in how this country thought of masturbation. Even though there was a dominant social opinion on it, you can be sure most people still grease the flagpole and polish their pearl. It's interesting to see how masculinity was so tied with discipline and femininity with virtue. Personally, I don't think anything's changed in that department from all that I've seen. It's strictly anecdotal. But I think virtue has been masked with different words, you know, like clean girl aesthetic and shit like that. But what do y'all think? We are at the end of this lovely episode. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much for tuning in with me. I can't wait to hear your thoughts or any ideas or connections that you made while listening. Literally my favorite thing ever. I love it when you guys reach out. Stay warm, stay safe, stay merry, and above all, comprehensive sex education is critical to healthy and empowered people. This is Can I Ask You Something? The Sex History Podcast. Until next time, happy holidays!